casino on the hill behind the firehouse in Ponce, the resort Paco had taken her to in Rincon for their honeymoon. It was dim, a lot less vibrant than the New York memories. She could barely remember anything about home, for home had really begun with the Mobilization for Youth Theater Project, the St. Mark's Poetry Group, the Committees of Defense for Carlos Feliciano, the Puerto Rican Student Union at City College, and then the Young Lords. She'd written faithfully to Compañeros of CAFU, a feminist action group that had sent expressions of solidarity to the Young Lords in the early 70s when she'd been correspondent secretary. She'd kept up communications over the years with most of the independistas, FUPI, JIU, MPI, who had direct and immediate links with groups in New York. But she'd gotten cut off in a way traveling with the troop. Transplants all. Inez, from Farm Valley Country, Chesia, from the Tuperqueen Hills, Nilda, from the contested Black Hills, Mai, from the hills of San Francisco, they like to joke, or the paddy fields of Berkeley, Cecile, from a maroon community in the hills of Jamaica. Only Palma was at home, and not even, she said it herself. Home was with them, or in the studio, or with her main man. But eventually, we all come to the hills, like in the poem, and they had to evoke it with music, dance, and encantados. Iris had ordered a fruit salad, a bowl of plantain chips, a sweet roll or bun if they had, and coffee, explaining carefully to the waiter that she wanted the coffee in a bowl and wanted the milk scalded. She was trying to stay awake till it got there. She had toyed with the idea of taking a leave and making a quick run to New York. But the group had dwindled so fast, and she'd promised. There was a Black women's conference in New Orleans to start with, a major reading sponsored by the Before Columbus Book Project to end with, just days before she was due in Mayagüez for the start of summer session. Not even enough time to lock herself up with the Berlitz long players. The kind of Spanish demanded at University of Mayagüez, she wasn't putting down at all. Nada, nada. But in between New Orleans and the Bay Area were several campus appearances, a benefit for the Farm Workers Union, some kind of Black and Indian thing that was jumping off right after the Tuskegee Air Show, and two visits to the joint. Iris got weary just thinking about it all, but that was always the way. The minute they got to setting up, though, it was all beautiful again. Things popped, and she cooked.
I think they're friends of Palma and Velma's, yes?
Mai was jabbing her pen in the direction of two women by the railing, clinking glasses of white wine.
Maybe they know where Velma is. We should ask.
Iris nodded, yeah, maybe, noticing how dragged out they all were. It seemed an effort for Chesia to turn her head. Cecile was bent over her plate, shrugging. Nilda had opened her eyes long enough to notice only half her order had come and now seemed fast asleep. Iris said nothing further, just smiled as Mai smiled when the two women looked their way. She was content to sit there and listen to the music. She listened for all of 8 bars, hunting up under the trumpet for the congas. She had seen the musicians go by and knew not to expect much. Ersatz salsa. She thought of the last time she'd caught Ray Beretta. It had been too long. La Lupe. She could cry. It had been that long. La Lupe, La Lupe, La Lupe. The thought of recruiting La Lupe as the next sister of the plantain woke her up. It was wild. It was perfect. La Lupe. Her replacement.
Taste, Iris. It's billed as a pina colada. Tell me I'm not crazy.
Iris waved Cecile's glass away.
She was saving herself for the black bean coffee, drowsing in her chair, thinking of how Paco made it with the nasty sock thing, and wondering if he'd started packing yet, sent out any feelers, found a lead on a job yet. They were both going to try to get through law school together. It was loco. But this is the kind of rum we use back home for cooking. Cecile was pouting, flirting with Campbell. You don't drink it, brother. You light it up. He took her glass away, very noticeably not flirting back. Cecile and Iris exchanged eyebrow lifts and slumped in their seats a bit, trying to second-guess where the wind would spring up next, under Cecile's hat, which was Nilda's, under the tablecloth edge, under Mai's dress. I hope it doesn't rain, Cecile said, motioning toward Nilda, who sat beyond the shadow of the awning. How would we get her to move? Self-centered. But that's a good thing, Ruby. Velma's never been the center of her own life before. Not really. You mean that Obi and the kid is the sun the dear sister revolves around, or what have you? No. Jan sucked at her sticky fingers. Neither of them, but especially Velma, she emphasized, ever set things up so they could opt for a purely personal solution. Quotes around personal, if you please. I hear you. It's like what you were saying earlier about wanting to retreat from confusion to your shop. Just you and the jewelry making, confined space, everything under your sure control. Not that you mean it, but that's what I mean by personal. Velma has worked hard not to hollow out a safe corner. Yeah, quotes around the safe of home, family, marriage, and then be less responsive, less engaged. Dodgy business trying to maintain the right balance there. The personal and the public, the club, heart cluster versus spades, diamonds, and a sun and Venus in Aquarius. Ah, I knew I'd get a rise out of you, Ruby. But it's good she has put herself at center at last, if that's what you meant by self-centered. Jan, I'm sick of the subject. Ruby sighed and clasped her hands behind the chair and cracked her elbows. I think my ass has fallen asleep and my legs, too. I also think this has been the first conversation we have ever had out of doors that didn't get interrupted thoroughly by some joker sidling up with the hey mama or hey foxes, like what we could possibly be talking about is nothing compared to some off-the-wall nonsense a brother could lay down. Don't cloud up. I'm just stalling, that's all. Try not to be an alarmist. Last time I pronounced somebody crazy, you were ready to line up the psychiatrists. Remember? You went tearing after Tina Mason's mother to get her to tackle Tina to the mat. You really had me going. Now, that bitch is really crazy, that Tina. Do you know what her latest thing is? She's got the studio over the Regal now. And now she plans to revive the ancient Earth Mother cult. Got posters, buttons, flyers, costumes, the works. And guess who she plans to cast in the role of ancient Primavera, support stockings and all? The boarding house lady whose great-grand-somebody got Harper's Ferry rolling. What's her name? The one whose son got messed over in the anti-draft rally the year we met. Sophie Haywood. Now, can you imagine that old bird traipsing down the street with Tina's crew in their X-rated all-in-all, a daisy chain around her head, flinging yams and golden delicious apples to the multitudes? As a matter of fact, I can. Mrs. Haywood will be riding the parade float this festival. And half her mixed bag crew of witches are doing this dance on the Heights Saturday night called Freedom in Romany for the Gypsies. That's a dance. You should see the flyer. And check this. She calls me to ask if Nate would be interested in joining her band of merrymakers. And would he?
Nigga, please. Who? That bitch crazier in hell. But I'm not talking about that brand of lunacy.
Velma, I wish she'd get here. I'd like to hear more about the computer caper.
Well, I'm glad Velma wasn't here in time for dessert, Ruby. The mere mention of plutonium and she goes off with dire predictions about a police state coming to ensure or at least minimize against unauthorized access to nuclear materials. She has so little faith.
In what?
The people. All this doomsday mushroom cloud end of planet number is past my brain. Just give me the good old-fashioned honky nigger shit. I think all this ecology stuff is a diversion.
They're connected. Whose community do you think they ship radioactive waste through or dig up waste burial grounds near? Who do you think they hire for the dangerous dirty work at those plants? What parts of the world do they test blast in? And all them illegal uranium mines dug up on Navajo turf? The crops dying, the sheep dying, the horses, water, cancer?
Ruby, cancer.
And the plant on the Harlem River? And, Ruby, don't get stupid on me.
You're sounding like Velma.
Hell, it's an emergency situation. Has been for years. All those thrown-together plants they built in the 40s and 50s are falling apart now. War is not the threat. It's all the peacetime construction that's wiping us out. And remember that summer we met? All those TB mobile units in the neighborhoods? Giving out lollipops and donuts and the kids going back 2, 3, 4 times for an X-ray? Oh, Ruby.
Yeah, I know there's a connection.
Ruby sighed, releasing her hands and dropping forward.
Pass the carafe.
Has the executive committee decided to take on the nuclear issue?
I voted it down.
Wait, hear me out. Now, we formed the group mainly to ensure input in local politics, right? An interim tactical something or other until the people quit fooling around and decide on united black political action, right? There's no sense taking on everything.
But Ruby, sister, heart of my heart, will you just tip your chin slightly northwest and swing your eyes in the direction of Gaylord and tell me what do you see?
You think there's no connection between the power plant and transchemical and the power configurations in this city and the quality of life in this city, region, country, world?
Sold. But can't I specialize just a wee bit longer in the local primitive stuff? Labor with the ordinary homegrown variety crackers and your everyday macho pain in the ass from the block?
Y'all take on this other thing. It's too big for me. I'm just your friendly neighborhood earring maker.
I hope you're kidding. Here, have some more wine. The tea's cold.
What I need is a real drink. Let's go hang out, unless you're deliberately hanging out to get something going with our literate friend, albeit a waiter.
What?
Janice, please, he's done everything but bite your neck and ravish you on the table.
Oh, I don't think he... Just a friendly type brother. I mean,
that is bullshit of a non-biodegradable sort. The man's got eyes. Deal with that at least.
Ruby, do me a favor.
Okay, I will shut up and drink my wine like a good girl, and then I will pay the check with this bogus credit card I traded a bogus Benin gold weight for.
You will pay cash money in the hand.
It's the least you can do, having saddled me with this questionnaire and a major decision to make about my life.
Right. Fine.
Now, is it my imagination, or are we at a rerun of Singing in the Rain?
Several young people who'd been boogieing in front of the record shack and others who'd hung drape-style around the cafe railing had rushed into the cafe's table area and were broken-field running among the tables, some walking wolf-style as if puddles already threatened Romeo Ballad loafers, yo-yos, candies, and Converse All-Stars.
others were ducking in anticipation of clearing the awning that could in no way be dripping yet. But it was. A sudden downpour with no warning, the light only now shifting from metallic lemon to a purple gray. Customers by the railing had already begun dragging their tables across the prized quarry tile, knee-bent, walking, and carrying their chairs on their behinds, these odd-shaped creatures colliding with equally strange bent-over runners darting in and out between waiters, the runaway dessert cart, and one or two stunned customers returning from the restrooms caught up in a turbulent, not sure what, something, hey, watch it, happening. Campbell got hemmed in the corner by the service counter, his order pad pressed against his throat, his elbow in a bowl of fruit salad not picked up, and he'd been about to make a connection. He'd been clutching at an idea, and it was trying to come together, congeal, get structured into something speakable. But now, with the ballpoint leaking against his shirt, the stain leaching ever closer to his skin as the contaminated soil in Barnwell reached the water table, it was slipping past him. But in the months ahead, he would remember the height of divinely egocentric association that lightning had flashed, lighting up the purple-smeared sky just as it came to him. Damballa. A grumbling, growling, boiling up, as if from the core of the earthworks, drew a groan from the crowd huddled together under the awning, in the doorway, as if to absorb the shock of it, of whatever cataclysmic event it might turn out to be. For it couldn't be simply a storm, with such frightening thunder as was cracking the air as if the very world were splitting apart. And whatever it was, it was no mere feet-thrumming intrusion of kids on ball bearings careening down the pavement, nor the drum talk of the dance studio, ta-ta-ta-ta-bakara, answered by the kapati-da-da-rada from the park, nor the rumbling of railroad cars. It could be the thunder of cannons. It could mean war, or angry gods demanding someone be flung into the crater, volcanoes boiling up, vomiting up flames and lava, death running in the streets soon to overtake the cafe, or an explosion at the plant. Folks were crowding together, sharing edges of chairs with strangers, offering bits of scalloped shadow from the oilskin roofing, spreading tents of newspapers on companions' heads, holding their breath, trying not to hear the dire prophecies or damn fool hunches of professional talkers accustomed to being asked their 2 cents worth and used to people listening. Many years hence, when rad and rem would riddle everyday speech and the suffix curies would radically alter all assumptions on which security had once been built, many would mark the beginning of it all as this moment. This moment, this light, this place, these strangers. All would be fixed more indelibly on the brain and have more lasting potency than circumstances remembered of that November day in 63. This moment, heart jarred and lungs starved, would supply the answers to the latter-day version of, what were you into when they wiped Lumumba out? Or, did you ever go past the Audubon Ballroom after they gunned Malcolm down? Or, where were you when the news came of King, of Ho, of Mao, of Che, of Fannie Lou? Were you wearing a fro the time they were hounding Angela across country? Did you raise funds for Mozambique, Angola? Were you part of the movement in D.C. in 63? Did you help pull the U.S. out of Vietnam, Eritrea, South Africa? Did you wear a fair play for Cuba button? Did you send defense funds for Joanne Little, for Inez Garcia, for Dennis Banks, for Russell Means, for the Wilmington 10? One would ask and be asked, when did it begin for you? One would make the journey to the cafe as if to market, to trade news, hunches, interpretations of news, gossips, dreams, flashes picked up from official and non-official sources regarding what was happening in other districts, other countries, other continents. And no one would say, across the border, for that entailed tiring explanations obliged the speaker to be precise about what border was meant, where Legba stood at the gate, where Isis lifted the veil, the probable realms of impossibility beyond the limits of scientific certainty, the uncharted territory beyond the danger zone of safe dosage, the brain, blood, or placenta barrier that couldn't screen plutonium out.
I could do without the soundtrack and the special effects.
Ruby shivered, grabbing hold of the table and urging Jan out of a freeze.
Sounded like the set for an MGM musical. Now I'm thinking this must be Poseidon 2 or Son of Inferno.
And Jan had lifted her end of the table, muttering into the teapot.
I hope it's not.
One would venture out into the streets to the cafe or some other familiar place from the old days where gatherings looked trustworthy and their huddle to trade stories, sifting and sorting among the tales as if at a rummage sale, taking on those pieces still wearable to get them through the passage, rejecting those pieces too threadbare, too contaminated, too cumbersome. One would run the back roads to the woods, not jogging in unpaid outfits, trampling chutes, not moving in with tents, dope, and bombed-out playmates mouthing off about we're into nature, not hiding out in Wordsworth or Kerouac, excusing the self from social action, but running to the woods in hopes of an audience with the spirits long withdrawn from farms and gardens, all withered and wasted, bringing eagle-bone whistles or gourd rattles or plaster saints or rakes and seeds or gifts of soap or sacks of cornmeal or sticks of licorice or cones of incense, anything one had to place on a tree stump altar or a turned rock shrine to lure the saving spirits out. To talk and be heeded finally. Stumbling through the thorns and briars, following the rada-rada big booming of the drums or the way-way-weeda riff of reed flutes, running toward a clearing, toward a likely sanctuary of the saints, the loa, the dins, the devas. And found would open up and welcome one in before the end. Welcome one in time to wrench time from its track so another script could play itself out. One would tap the brain for any knowledge of initiation rites lying dormant there, recognizing that life depended on it, that initiation was the beginning of transformation, and that the ecology of the self, the tribe, the species, the earth depended on just that. In the dark of the woods, the ground shaking underfoot, the ancient covenants remembered in fragments, one would stand there, fists pummeling the temples, trying to remember the whole in time and make things whole again. And remembering, too, that thunderclap heard in the cafe years ago that was Ogun's shouting answer to the African workers who labored for life's renewal, was Thor at the anvil beating swords into spades, was Wagner's Siegfried striking a blow, was living archetypes sounding the knell of the authoritarian age, the thunderous beginning of the new humanism, the new spiritism, if only attention could be riveted on the simplicity of the karmic law, cause and effect. There were choices to be noted, decisions to be made. It was raining, a furiously relentless rain, as if it meant to go on forever. Ruby abandoned her trampled hat, watched it slide away under the railing. Rain drumming on the tables, tiles, awning, answered by the sucking thud of people running by, the squish of cars and trucks and car horns getting stuck. A woman's voice, high-pitched and hysterical, called out from somewhere, "Freddy?" and sent chills up the collective spine. The hanging pots were swinging,
overflowing, dollops of mud on the tile, some falling at last and banging, the contents oozing away in a slide. Ruby pulled the turtleneck up that was a hood and hugged her friend closely. Both thought the same thoughts, but could not speak, simply hugged each other tightly, trying to think of something funny to break the mood, break the other's hold. Jan was flexing her hands against Ruby's back as if arthritis threatened or honey was bonding her fingers. A muscular response to some dimly heard instruction in her mind to loosen her grip now on all notions of the seemingly complete world, release her hold on notions that might lock her to the old. There was a second flash of lightning, and that gesture of the spread open hand, that thought unfinished but intuited, got fixed and would hold its shape for decades to come. "I hope it's not," spoken into the teapot, marking Jan's beginning. Suddenly, it was quiet but for the rain. The waiters were passing out napkins like medicos with bandages at the front. And in a while, joviality would ease back into the company and erase the terror. But in too short a while, the very threat of rain would revive the terror, be more terrible than anything experienced by anyone in that rehearsal moment. Rain that would cancel out the possibility of any joviality and make a napkin wipe off a ludicrous memory not to be repeated by any sane person. Nilda, her hat blown off, her hair barely held down at the side by the barrette, barely secured in back by the leather strap, was still sitting with her eyes closed and her arms folded in her lap. Cecile had shouted when they moved to shove the table closer to the wall, cutting off the waiter's exit and possibly his circulation. Though Campbell had been stunned still with no thought of movement that might jar the idea taking shape, so simple a connection, he'd known it for years, but had failed to appreciate it. Of course, everything was everything. Hadn't Mustafa taught him that? And he'd written it down on the back of the pad. "Dambala," he wrote, "represents," he wrote, and scratched that out. "Dambala is similar to," he wrote, and scratched that out. "Dambala is the first law of thermodynamics and is the biblical wisdom and is the law of time, and is," Campbell wrote, "everything that is now has been before and will be again in a new way, in a changed form, in a timeless time." Neither Cecile nor any of the others called to Nilda, sitting there 3 feet from the awning, an island unto herself. It was clear she was not asleep, and was not concerned with the rain's pelting of her velvet shirt, darkening now to blue-black ink. Nilda was in the hills with the peyotero, listening to the tongue of the sacred cactus where our elder brother, the deer of the sun, resides. In the hills, becoming available to the spirits summoned to regenerate the life of the world.
12. Dom, tetetiki, dom dear. One side of the hill calling to the other. Bataka teka bembiwa. The call and response, drums on the move, a gathering summoned. Rada rada boom tetawa. Echoed from the park. Rada ready tum vida om. Feedback and contagion. Slashed tree pitch ooze, chopped down, hollowed out, rum-burnt tree drums, green-black mottled gold, thumped. Velma can feel them in the walls as she races down corridors, a cornmeal-marked trail. Pollen veves on the walls blurred as she runs through passageways in search of a particular chamber that might not be sealed off if she hurries and doesn't think too much on limitations. I can't read drums, so how do I know they're saying barrier dropping? She regrets the thought.
The cornmeal is slippery now. No traction, off direction, the drums pushing the walls out of shape, and a draft of air in her face, and she could lose her breath once and for all. Reed flutes blowing foie dia in her hair, her nose, her lungs, tripping over notes and thoughts and falling up the attic stairs, a tonic breeze pushing through the cracks in the floorboards. She is face down now, pressed between the slats, and breath returns. Sweetheart. She pulls up and sits like a cat, one paw resting lightly on a Christmas bulb. She is imitating a sphinx, playing distraction. Madeir wants to talk of Christ. She prefers charades. She is Sphinx now, and watches child and godmother pack away the tree ornaments in tin boxes of excelsior. No more room in that box, my dear. In the heart? Room in the heart, V? You mean like no room in the inn? There was no room in the heart, V. And you? Understanding now, still. And watching like a sphinx, poised, centered, music coming at her through cracks in the walls, floors, window frames, a wind in the ribcage, a tremor in the lungs, rustling the packet straw in the floor of the heart. She's off again. Take care, men. You don't lose her. Time to hit the yellow brick road, is it? Stay close, old wife. A brass band coming, shiny sounds making the passageway slippery, the barrier down, as promised, and she can skip along now, cymbals crashing by her ear and the leaves shuddering as the procession passes. She waits in the branches of Philosophy 101, time streaming along below her in the tree. Dogs caught in the shower shiver growl and bite the curbstones. Cats with their ears laid back hiss, seeing what the marchers will not train themselves to see. So what do I do now? Is you is or is you ain't my spirit guide? Loan her some of your stuff, men, and don't be stingy. I'm about worn out. A grand piñata suspended festive from the branch. The hitting stick wants a stake in young men's yard, wants a stake in a robber baron's heart way before that. The children, shrieking and jumping, strike down bits of grace, and Velma jumps out of the tree and is on the path going asphalt, running backward now the way Nilda had once prophesied. Hoodoo man looks at her with maroon eyes and leaps out of the LaSalle Street projects at her, snarling. Feathered bonnet tossing, beads and tiny mirrors flashing in the yards of Marabou, trailing and twisting behind him as he bounds, all manner of wenga clanking on his breastbone. She is caught in the crush of neighbors streaming out of doors now, the child sent out to call up the sun, having given the signal to begin. They're heading for the first watering hole of the day, the package store, with rattles, tambourines, zimbi gourds, and paper cups. The rata tambours in the suede hands of the young brown boys and dark old men trotting alongside the procession, chanting praise songs to their chief, who waits on the balcony overhanging the regal marquee. Cups of wine passing overhead to keep the praises coming on smooth, and she is trying to back out, to run the other way. That's Velma Henry for you. One on the sideliner remarks, always going against the grain. Always was contrary. She is trotting backward down Gaylord Hill with no brakes on, skidding into bus posts, colliding into flower-smothered floats where folks pin on notes, prayers, and dollar bills. Musician men tie scarves around their hips and hand her one. Red scarves, red war, red wound, red Ogun, who can endow the gift of prophecy and cure, protector of warriors and travelers, too. She ties her sash, her red hips darkening in the rain. Rope sashes holding up croaker pants and burlap tunics drenched and tightening. Metal collars on necks wet, the chain passing through loops linking row on row of elders, young'uns, men and women
fastened to the side panels of the truck, padlocked and rain spattered. Someone hoists her up by the wrists, and there's no pain. She is jammed between bodies, barely rocking as the truck, like a rag and bones cart, trundles along the cobblestone street. She looks for Obi, head shaven, tattoo burnt in left forearm. He is there. He sees her. She sees him. She sees, too, the guns wrapped in cloth, the bombs of 2-inch pipes buried in the sawdust pile the children sit on. This is not his way. Who talked him into going along with this? She stares the question at him. There are so many between them now, there can be no privacy.
Do what I tell you,
he says.
Get away. Be safe. This once.
She shakes her head, stubborn.
Why won't you give me this one thing?
If I start giving, Obi, I'll give everything. She does not say. She backs out of the truck, and it thunders past. There are chains on the doors of the Regal Theater. To lock gatecrashers out, explain the security guards, but folks break through the line to rap on the glass doors. I gotta use the bathroom. Emergency, let me use the phone. My kid's in there. But I've already got my ticket. When a guard juts his chin toward the closed-down box office. Chains on the door and folks inside for the concert and the shortwave speaking of things getting out of control all over town. And what would the audience do if they knew the Regal had been opened without a proper fire inspection and was now locked up by a bunch of Keystone cops who might be able to find the key if trouble started, but then again, might not. It's raining harder now, and the line disperses. Folks free now to leave, free to run elaborately off at the mouth about their ingenious and fearless plans for getting into the Regal, for breaking kin and neighbor out of the Regal if only it hadn't gone and rained. And knowing all the while, which makes the telling all the more extravagant, that the moment to do whatever there was to do had come when they were being driven out, had come when they were being told to line up, had come when the doors were being closed in their faces, had come when the bar bolts were being thrown, had come when the chains appeared. She's inside. The audience deliberately mistaking the thunder for a backstage drum roll. Last time a demonstration was threatened at Transchemical, all power was cut off in the district and blamed on the storm most folks remembered as a drizzle merely. So they hear drums. She would sit still and remember not to kick at the seat in front or Mama May would slap her knees, and she kept her eyes off the cave in the wall. She liked looking at the giant blackamoors against the side, bulging chests and balloon pants, looming straight past the box seats and up toward the sky, the chipped noses and scaly turbans hardly visible in the dark. Their huge fans that Mama May called bald chins, waving in the navy blue heavens with the clouds and stars. She liked them. Might ask to be taken to the bathroom if she could escape for a chance to run her hands over the vests that looked like gold. But the curve in the wall that her unruly eyes always tried to slide around for a glimpse of the rubied swords hanging in the cave, hanging in space like a magic trick, she would not look there. The swords had disappeared when she was 7. This disappearing act was magical enough, but the pictures that started coming in the cave, the mud mothers with enormous teeth painting themselves with long hairbrushes, painting pictures on the walls of the cave, that was too much. She would lean way back in the seat and stare at the phony sky and wait for the movie to end. Just as she leaned back in church in the wooden pews and waited for the sermon to end, determined not to look in the dark hollow behind the statues standing in the walls around the congregation. In the attic, they came in the mirror once. 10 or more women with mud hair, storing yams in gourds and pebbles in cracked calabash, and tucking babies in hairy hides. They came like a Polaroid. Stepping out of the mouth of the cave, they tried to climb out of the speckled glass, talk to her, tell her what must be done all over again, all over again, all over again.
but she hung an old velvet drape over the mirror and smothered them. They were not going to run her off her own place, not the attic. Mothballs drop from sweaters, from plastic sacks hung near the window. Mothballs roll from boxes where the squirrels have been gnawing before repelled. Mothballs roll across the attic floor till inertia holds them near her feet. She leans from the eaves as from a branch and misses nothing. The marchers, trudging alongside the truck, are soaked. Wetbacks, she smiles. Something to tell Inez if the sisters come for lunch. There is much movement in the truck. Someone unwrapping guns, distributing armloads of weapons, tearing open boxes of ammunition. What for? She can't remember. Children, unseated, scoot between legs and jump from the truck to join friends on the sidelines. Some race across the street, taking chances in the traffic that's not been closed off. Even from her perch, it is clear the chains are made of cardboard, a patina of black. Greasy paint glistening in the rain, running like makeup, like mud, like mind, like time. Velma shivers and then relaxes. Something silky cool but body warm is being pressed against her. Grown-ups on the sidelines are cheering artificial chains and actors, the floats, the costumes, the whole idea of festival, rushing the procession on toward the park, toward the sizzling food, the steamy pushcarts, the incense-fragrant booths, the drums, and the dancing. There's cheering in the park, then jeering, wine bottles being hurled from cars speeding by, cars not of the district. Bottles, cans, rocks, jeers like the rock concert night that time she talked Obi, Palma, and Marcus into going, not for the music, but because they needed to know so much more about Claiborne's finest, about riot control techniques. And the lead singer spotted straights in the front row with flash cameras blinding as at the zoo and sang fuck in their faces, and the cops rushed the stage as the chant pig, pig went up, and bottles too. Cans, rocks went up from the audience and came down from the trees where the troublemakers waited. And Marcus said, later for this, and Obi grabbing the sisters by the hand, and no one said, I told you so, or you and your damn research, because it had been an instructive evening. Squad cars pull into the park, sprawl all over the grass. An officer tells the festival committee that the permits have been revoked, and there are questions, too, about the licenses to sell food, especially booze, in City Park. She gets there too late to understand what is happening, but sees the cops seeing a rioting horde of nigger-niggers and other type niggers racing from the park green, abandoning their litter, rushing for the hill back of the vacant lot where only gods know what weapons might be stashed, grappling up the hill, uprooting shrubs and bushes in the climb to the main street lined with boutiques, cafes, and travel agencies, stampeding the tourists and racing down the block toward the hill to the heights for the shortcut to Transchemical. And they call in for reinforcements, the vigilante on the airwaves moving out. The people who've already bid Carne Vale, following a different calendar, turn in the street and see a disciplined army or a mob, a shaming reminder of things best forgotten, or an interesting bit of theater rained out, too bad, or thank goodness, 'cause everybody's nerves are shot, the whole town on edge. She is in the park, around the bonfire, singing. Minnie is there. Madeir. Doc Surge, and some older man she doesn't know by name, the face faintly familiar, but the green uniform throwing her off. And Obi is there, Mama May, Palma, and Lil James called Jabari now, and Marcus, and someone or something hovering near, daring her to look, to recognize. Not an old friend, but someone she hasn't met but ought to know but dare not look at. A taboo glance, formidable, ancient, locking her jaws, her thighs, keeping her head down. Medusa, Lot's wife, Eurydice, Noah, she will not look. She keeps her eyes on her feet, swollen from stomping. They are all stomping,
agitating the ground, agitating an idea, calling up something or someone, and the idea clusters in the image centers and settles there. She will not look at that either. It is taking all of her to concentrate on not looking. She would not have cut Medusa's head off, she is thinking, watching the mud come up worms between her toes. She would simply have told the sister to go and comb her hair, or gotten a stick to drive the serpents out. Serpents or snakes. She draws a line in the dirt with her big toe. Different remedies for snake bite and the bite of the serpent she'd been hearing for a lifetime. Daddy Dolphy had told her too in the woods that time. Medir had dropped her basket and slit his shirt with her shears before Velma knew what had happened. Had pushed him on the ground and taken his knife from him and slit open his shoulder before Velma could cry out. Quick, salt. And she'd managed to find it in the gathering basket and knew somehow it was salt and not some other odd thing to be bringing along to the woods. Daddy Dolphy had gulped some, held some in his mouth, and was ripping off his sleeve when Medir snatched a fistful of leaves from a bush and packed a salt poultice into the wound and tied up his shoulder tightly with a sleeve tourniquet. Helps neutralize the venom, Medir explained, her voice calm, as if certain the twisting of the sleeve would do the rest.
To neutralize the serpents, another matter, Daddy Dolphy had winked, taking deep breaths.
She thought she knew that. At some point in her life, she was sure Douglas, Tubman, the slave narratives, the songs, the fables, Delaney, Ida Wells, Blyden, Du Bois, Garvey, the singers, her parents, Malcolm, Coltrane, the poets, her comrades, her godmother, her neighbors, had taught her that. Thought she knew how to build immunity to the sting of the serpent that turned would-be cells, could-be cadres, into cargo cults. Thought she knew how to build resistance, make the journey to the center of the circle, stay poised and centered in the work and not fly off, stay centered in the best of her people's traditions and not be available to madness, not become intoxicated by the heady brew of degrees and career and congratulations for nothing done, not become anesthetized by dazzling performances with somebody else's aesthetic, not go under. Thought the workers of the 60s had pulled the family safely out of range of the serpent's fangs so the workers of the 70s could drain the poisons, repair damaged tissues, retrain the heartworks, realign the spine. Thought the vaccine offered by all the theorists and activists and clear thinkers and doers of the warrior clan would take. But amnesia had set in anyhow. Heart, brain, gut muscles atrophied anyhow. Time was running out anyhow, and the folks didn't even have a party, a consistent domestic and foreign policy, much less a way to govern. Something crucial had been missing from the political, economic, social, cultural, aesthetic, military, psychosocial, psychosexual mix. And what could it be? And what should she do? She'd been asking it aloud one morning combing her hair, and the answer had almost come tumbling out of the mirror, naked and tattooed, with serrated teeth and hair alive, birds and insects peeping out at her from the mud-heavy hanks of the ancient mother's hair. And she had fled feverish and agitated from the room, flopped languid and dissolved at Jamal's, lest she be caught up and entrapped in glass. Fled, lest she be ensorcelled, fled, finally, into a sharp and piercing world, fled into the carbon cave. And now, standing there barefoot on the ground in the park, she still could not face up, would not lift her head to look at anything but her own swollen feet. She might steal a glance sideways at the woman next to her and study the elegant shoes, the red and gold and white sequined ruffles at the hem of the extravagant gown, the hands clasped with three wedding bands shining on the ring finger, before she wrenched her eyes back to the safety of her swollen feet. There might be an answer, but she would not look up from her feet. It was a woman, all right, next to her, trying to get familiar. She used the same brand of sandalwood soap, too. She felt her more than anything else, a glow, as if she were beaming at her, not daring now, but inviting her to look. She didn't risk it. What was her name? Madeir never used a name. The mailbox probably read Mr. and Mrs. Lott. Period. Surely she'd gotten the flyers. She was on the mailing list, seen the posters, read the papers, knew what they were trying to do to effect change. Maybe the thing to do was invite the self by for coffee and a chat. Share with her how she herself had learned to believe in ordinary folks' capacity to change the self and transform society. What in hell could anybody do with a salt lick in the middle of the LaSalle projects anyway? There were no cows in Claiborne anymore. She drew another line in the dirt.
I was out of town, she would explain to the silent bride. Sorry I missed the wedding. Heard the cops turned the reception out and nabbed Bubba Orff. Now, if Leadbelly could turn a heart of stone judge around with a strum or two, surely there's no need for you to be laid out on a slab in the infirmary. We can redeem Orff's guitar. Where the pawn tickets?
Sweetheart. Some kind of wife, some kind of mother you turned out to be. Your children hanging in the bedroom doorway snickering at their daddy. My mother would have knocked us clean across the room, and then the lecture, her cooking spoon raised and her eyes slit, warning no back talk and you better not roll your eyes or suck your teeth. So long as you are in this house, you will respect your father, who puts food in your mouth and clothes on your back.
Sweetheart.
They called her Sweet Pea. Her name was Barbara Watson. She'd come down from Syracuse to work with Snick and find a husband. Those niggas up there have no politics. Came down from D.C. a full decade later for something Velma was not sure she had to give. Driving to West Palm Beach to see my in-laws, ex-in-laws, still friendly, thought I'd drop by and see how you all are making out, pay my respects. Heard you and Smitty never did hook up, should have grabbed him myself. Well, we're still here, intimidated by a look that said anything but respect. You seem the same, Velma, crazy as ever. Looking at the tables tumbled down with leaflets and pamphlets, the boxes of rolled-up posters, the mimeo machine in the middle of the living room. Same-o, same-o, huh? Touching her hair, a color Velma couldn't remember. She didn't know what the sister wanted, sitting there smoking one after another, describing her latest march down the butt and spit-spattered aisle of City Hall, talking on and on, bits and snatches of jailhouse anecdotes and back-road remembrances, as if all that had happened a century ago and the war was over, asking after everyone but not listening to Velma's answers, and that smile that was anything but a smile. We're all still here, was all Velma could think to say. And still into the same idealistic nonsense, I gather. Sounding edgy, irritable. You honestly think you can change anything in this country? Her anger flaring now, bewildering. I try to live, Velma said, surprised at her evenness, so it doesn't change me too much. You'll learn. She snapped back and seemed to be getting up to go, except she wasn't, just changing positions. And Velma was waiting for the bedroom clock to go off so she could announce she had a meeting to attend. You'll learn, she said again. I want to learn to grow, to become no longer talking to Barbara Sweet Pea Watson. Her lips, soft against each other, Velma was searching for a way to finish the sentence, wondering if indeed it was already complete. Well, she said, and this time she was dumping cigarette case, lighter, address book, and pen into her bag and rising to go.
Just thought I'd come by and see how everybody's doing, like being in a time capsule, you know? She was trying to exit on a big note. Thank God I got out of here in time. She was trying to slam a swinging door. She sounded tired.
We're still here.
Velma shrugged, not at all tired. There seemed to be so much more to say. She shook out the glad you stopped by the way Mama May would, upending her bag, but no grits left.
I wish you well, sweet pea.
So long.
Shove over, old wife, while I put this music on. What you think? Something low down and nasty or something upbeat and inspiring? The Henry gal is coming through. Now, which?
It's immaterial to me, men.
You hear yourself. You're a blip if there ever was one.
Takes one to know one, men. You gonna dismiss them haints? Seems like they plenty folks calling on them.
They're free to go wherever, and that's no lie.
Strains of some sassy 20s singer crackling low and indistinct grazed Velma's ears with,
Wild women don't worry. Wild women don't have no blues.
Like the hissing of the Primus stove in Madeir and Daddy Dolphy's oceanfront cottage, like the zizzing of the Zimby gourds, the snakes in Sister's hair, the buzzing of them spooky trees outdoors where no bees ever were, no matter how hard you looked. She thought she heard some singing, something about being no angel, child. She was about to suck her teeth when the voice urged her to get real wild, was about to suck her teeth and mutter, signifying Sister, meaning the singer and the healer, too. She moved to wrap Minnie's shawl more tightly around her. She could be coming apart, totally losing herself. That woman in the park? Who was that but another her? Apart. But then, clear and bold, stopping her in mid-act, her arms in an arc, clear and bold as if recorded fresh that minute, as if incarnate. And not a wave, not a spirit captured by an electric tongue come back to speak, blasting new and not from her long-ago little girl days hanging out in Palma's growing-up girl days, came an alto sax loud and insistent taking over the air, jarring her out of her fear of splintering, blaring through her head. Not the hucklebuck, as in do the hucklebuck in some 5-watt blue bulb stomp down street alley dance hall place, and she, with too much makeup on, getting maneuvered into a dark corner, thigh on thigh, and nothing romantic and nice about it. But Charlie Parker doing, now is the time, coaxing from her something muscular and daring, something borrowed first from books and imaginings, then later from Palma's giggly narratives in the dark sharing a pillow, borrowed till she earned it for herself on that first piano in the church and learned to listen to linears and verticals at the same time, new time, rhythm, bam. Why bird, so bold and urgent, and the hawk doing something to the soles of her feet? She all but pushed off from the floor to fling herself out of the window and into the dark socket of the tree, knocking on the inside, as if eager to be a drum or join the chorus of voices speaking to her as from a dream. Into the socket, and seeing the baby bird that crashed there crumpled now and calling to the air, fluttering around Minnie's Govey and Zen and dream for sure, 'cause how could she know what to call the jugs and bowls but in a dream? Out of the window, stepping nimbly over the pitchers and pots and twirling in the yard, dancing round the perimeter of the tabby wall to the front of the building to count off the infirmary's pillars like her teacher Madeir had taught her to do. First pillar, God is. Two, God is all and all is one. Three, there are spirits. Four, there are prophets. Five, there'll be a day of restoration. Six,
but the pillar Medir had saved till she came through religion and came of age was no longer there, had been struck by lightning years before and removed. But still, the archway held.
Day of restoration,
Velma muttered, feeling the warm breath of Minnie Ransom on her, lending her something to work the bellows of her lungs with, to keep on dancing like the sassy singer said. Dancing on toward the busy streets alive with Winty, Coyote and Cunny Rabbit, and Turtle and Caribou, as if heading for the Ark in the new tidal wave, racing in the direction of resurrection as should be, and she had a choice, running, running in the streets, naming things. Cunny Rabbit called Impala, called Little Deer, called Trickster, called Brother, called Change. Naming things amidst the rush and dash of tires, feet, damp dresses swishing by, the spirits of blessing way outrunning disaster, outrunning jinns, shetnwai, subaka, succubi, inocui, incubi, nefari, the demons midwifed, suckled and fathered by the 1 in 10 mama warned about who come to earth for the express purpose of making trouble for the other 9. Demons running the streets, defying Earth Mother and Heavenly Father, and defiling the universe in a stampede rush, rending, tearing creature ideas, jumping through billboards and screw thy neighbor paperbacks, the modern grimoires of the passing age. And she, standing now in the wet streets as if there were a choice available, now that she'd been rescued from the scissors and the oven's gas. Same day. In ancient moccasins passing by her, outrunning them all as spoken of in Nilda's poems, as woven in the wampum belt, as drawn in the sand, as beamed from the Horus eye, from the feathered serpent's eye, as sung about when the 7 sisters took the stage. And she'd have to travel the streets in 6/8 time, 'cause Dizzy said righteous experience could not be rendered in 3/4 time. But this was why Bird, not Dizzy, and she was holding fast the rim of the stool lest she fall off and lose the beat altogether and be lost.
Let her go, men. Dancing is her way to learn now. Let her go.
And what about my legs? My legs. We might lose her. Give her your legs, old wife.
She could dance right off the stool. Right off the edge of the world and collide with comets scheduled for a splashdown on her 50th birthday and not miss a thing. Dance off into space with snakes in her hair and tusks sprouting from her gums and her head thrown back and singing, cheering, celebrating all those giants she had worshipped in their terrible musicalness. Giant teachers teaching through tone and courage and inventiveness, but scorned. Rebuked, beleaguered, trivialized, commercialized, copied, plundered, goofed on by half-upright pianos and droopy drawers drums and horns too long and hock and spitting up rust and blood, tormented by sleazy bookers and takers, tone-deaf amateurs and saboteurs, underpaid and overworked and sideswiped by side-saddle-riding groupies till they didn't know, didn't trust, wouldn't move on the wonderful gift given, and were mute, crazy, and beat up. But standing up in their genius anyhow, ready to speak the unpronounceable, on the stand with no luggage and no maps and ready to go anywhere in the universe together on just sheer holy boldness. Boldness and design, Medir would say, always said on the subject of black anything, and why hadn't she listened? Dispossessed, landless, this and that-less, and free, therefore to go anywhere and say anything and be everything if we'd only know it once and for all. Simply slip into the powerful power hanging unrecognized in the back hall closet. Velma felt her knees falling away at right angles, felt the curtain going up on a drama of none other than her own pantied stuff, center stage. And so what? She didn't have time to care, to pull the hospital gown down 'cause she was in the streets and in a tunnel on her hands and knees and burrowing under the quilts in Madeir's bed, mutton suet and sassafras oil warming her chest, and cared for, and being fed tincture of something wonderful and awful from a spoon washed down with chicken soup, while Madeir told her that long tale of hers in a tongue not known, then like, "Now I lay me down to sleep, I pray to Laud," not being real words, till later, speaking a special tale in a special voice, and she up under the quilts, sucking on a chicken bone, eager to crack the bone and crack the code, suck at the secret marrow of the thing, and Madeir droning on, "Back in the days when the earth was steady and the ground reliable underfoot, we made our covenant with our Maker and were given our instructions." And leading her on into, down past, familiar, drawing her from the known words, and always ending talking about the power available if we'd only look in that back hall closet. And damn, if she didn't want to get right up from between the healer's hands, get up and quit being some funny time sandwich, as Mama May would say, and go ask her godmother about them things told at night, fluffing up the pillow for her and smoothing down the sheet over the quilt to kiss her goodnight. All the talk that had begun the day Palmud led her back by the hand from the marshes, and Madeir had said it was only proper to do one seeking on one's knees, which shut Palma up and Mama May too. Get up and go seeking again. Knock on all the doors in Claiborne and quick too before the procession began for real. Knock and be welcomed in and free to roam the back hall on the hunt for that particular closet with the particular hanging robe, coat, mantle, veil, or whatever it was, and get into it, sport it, parade around the district in it so folks would remember themselves, would hunt for their lost selves. And hadn't Nilda and Inez told her about hunting? Hadn't Mazda explained what it was to stalk, to take over the hunted, but not with arrows or bullets, but with the eye of the mind? And hadn't she observed the difference, watched the different brands of hunting? The pulling of the bow, the pulling of the truck alongside the prey and mowing it down, taking it over. The cars pulling up alongside a woman or a kid ready to sell the self for a Twinkie, bringing down a bird or a woman or a man stalked at a dance, taking over a life. That was not hunting, as the sisters explained it, sang it, acted it out. To have dominion was not to knock out, downpress, bruise, but to understand, to love, make at home. The keeping in the sights, the animal or child, man or woman, tracking it in order to learn their way of being in the world. To be at home in the knowing. The hunt for balance and kinship was the thing, a mutual courtesy. She would run to the park and hunt for self, would be wild, would look. And up under the brass of horn and cymbals was the sister still singing faintly, "Wild women don't worry." But it was hard to concentrate 'cause something was happening. She was about